You are listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Advanced Academic Programs in Washington, D.C. Sitting in my office today is Dr. Maciej Bartkowski. Dr. Bartkowski is Senior Director for Education and Research at the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict here in the Washington, D.C. area. And in this capacity, he has spoken on his subject literally around the world, from Egypt to Colombia to Hong Kong. He holds a PhD in political science and also an MA in international relations and European studies from Central European University in Budapest, Hungary. And he did his undergraduate work at the American University of Central Asia in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, and he speaks an alarming number of languages. I think it'd be fair to say he's a citizen of the world. He's also the editor of a book published in 2013 entitled Recovering Nonviolent History, Civil Resistance in Liberation Struggles. And for our purpose, perhaps most importantly, Dr. Bartkowski teaches for us here in our Global Security Studies Master's Program. He teaches the course Civil Resistance, The Logic of Strategic Nonviolent Conflict, which we'll be offering again this fall. So Maciej Bartkowski, welcome.
Thank you for this generous introduction.
So today I wanted to talk about strategic nonviolent conflict in general, and then the Ukrainian situation more in particular. Strategic nonviolent conflict, of course, is your specialty. It's what you've made your career on. So do you just want to take a minute and tell us what is strategic nonviolent conflict? It almost sounds oxymoronic, but perhaps not quite. So maybe you can elucidate that for us.
Sure. Nonviolent conflict, it's nonviolent contestation, which is done outside of established political channels of conflict. So usually one would use either elections or party politics or courts in order to influence certain political changes. In a number of states, those kind of channels are not available, and then people may resort to different types of nonviolent actions in order to press for political change.
So what sort of nonviolent actions might we be talking about hypothetically?
There are hundreds of nonviolent actions that people would use. It could be strikes, civil disobedience, protests, boycotts. They can be classified differently as tactics of concentration, where people would come together on the streets to protest, and, for example, tactics of dispersion, where people would stay at home and not do things that the governments would expect them to do, like, for example, going to work or even doing shopping in the downtown mall, where they could then just stay at home and engage in the boycott.
So how is all of this different from the nonviolent means that, you know, Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King preached to us?
Interestingly enough, there is really not a major difference, because both of those leaders of nonviolent movements were also great strategists. And they were successful oftentimes not only because they espouse certain moral values and ethics about nonviolence, but also because they strategically and rigorously planned their nonviolent campaigns, where they were waged, how they were waged. They also plan maintaining nonviolent discipline for the purpose, for the strategic purpose, for example, of creating backfire when the violence would be used against unarmed nonviolent protesters.
And then look bad.
And that would, of course, reflect badly on those authorities who would use violence. And usually the violence has one purpose of making people stop doing things, for example. And back in the backfire process, oftentimes, instead of making people stop, violence backfires and mobilizes people to join resistance.
But would it be fair to say that the moral underpinnings of strategic nonviolent conflicts are different from, say, what Gandhi or King would have said, that they're about pacifism, and proponents of strategic nonviolent conflict are not necessarily pacifists? Is that a fair statement?
Well, actually, again, it's interesting that both of those leaders were avoiding, and they were actually emphasizing that what they are doing is not pacifism at all. It's not pacifism and pacifist. Gandhi actually introduced the term civil resistance because when he looked at the non-violent struggle of Hungarians against Austrians, which in the writings of that time was referred to as passive resistance, in contrast to active resistance, which would describe the kind of armed resistance.
Like guerrilla warfare, that sort of thing.
Exactly. So around the time of Gandhi, the very popular word to describe nonviolent actions was passive resistance. And Gandhi rejected that, saying that what we are engaged in is very active. It's not pacifist. It's not about establishing peace, but like Václav Havel was writing about disturbing peace. So Gandhi said we have to also come up with new terms for what we do. And he actually came up with the term civil resistance. And similarly, Martin Luther King, he said that civil resistance is actually a strategy to dramatize injustice. And in order to dramatize injustice, you have to stir tensions and conflict. Because oftentimes those injustices are buried beneath our daily activities. And we oftentimes just accept them.
Maybe you don't even consciously think about them, perhaps.
That could be the case. And also those victims may who are kind of subject to this injustice, they just go along with it. I mean, they got used to that to a certain extent. They are the victims after all, so they are powerless. They cannot do anything. And Martin Luther King was saying that one has to engage in actions in order to dramatize these injustices and then educate the public about the goal of the movement. So both of those people were very much strategists. And then it's true that most of the people who are engaged in nonviolent conflict, they do that from the strategic point of view rather than ethical principled approach. So, for example, if I were to interview solidarity leaders during the beginning of the 80s and or people on Tahrir Square and ask them why they are actually on Tahrir Square doing what they are doing without arms and non-violently, is it because they are pacifist? Most of them would say, no, we are not pacifists. We would probably take arms if we thought that this would be the best strategic approach to take down communist regime or Mubarak regime. But we think intuitively, or maybe through some kind of training and education, that actually the best way to make major political change is to pressure the authorities without arms, but at the same time engaging in various types of disruptive and coercive nonviolent actions.
Well, I was going to come to this in a minute, but since you've raised it, I'll ask it now. What are the limits of the possible in strategic nonviolent conflict? I mean, presumably its utility, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but its utility against enemies like the Nazis, who will just kill everybody if they feel like doing it, or perhaps even, say, the Soviets, or, you know, back in the day, the East Germans, who had such an incredibly pervasive system of surveillance, presumably against such enemies, it's going to be of very little use, I would think, or am I wrong?
Well, any repression, it's not good for the movement. Major type of or total repression certainly limits the opportunities for the movement. But it doesn't mean that, for example, in Nazi Germany or under Nazi occupation, there were no acts of civil resistance. Actually, there is a excellent book written by Jacques Semmelin called Unarmed Against Hitler. And in essence, in those campaigns and examples of civil resistance that we know, that civil resistance worked quite well. It was most of the time was quite successful. Whether we talked about Danish nonviolent resistance against Nazi occupation of the country, or if we talked about German women in Berlin in 1943 organizing spontaneous protests and demonstrations to demand the release of the Jewish husbands that were arrested in Berlin and were kept in the Gestapo headquarters. Eventually they were released. And so in those instances that we know of, for example, under the Nazi regime, they were successful. Perhaps the question could be more, or the conclusion could be made that perhaps this civil resistance could have been used much more frequently, given how effective it was against Nazis, rather than shouldn't be used because it was ineffective. Because again, it was effective in a number of cases, most of the time, it was just not used frequently, in contrast to the armed resistance. Even in North Korea, you've got examples of civil resistance individual, or even collective civil resistance organizing. I mean, just an example of last year, Google finally mapped Pyongyang with the pictures of the capital. Now, it's you cannot take pictures of the capital. It's a punishment, either labor camps or death sentence, which actually implied that you've got a network of people inside of North Korea taking those pictures, and then network of smugglers taking those pictures out of North Korea to South Korea or through China, and then eventually to Google. So this and this is a subversive kind of actions, and oftentimes that's the start where of future more open resistance against the regime, the more kind of tacit and hidden type of actions.
On a somewhat related note, there's been a lot of discussion in recent years about the role of social media, you know, Twitter, Facebook, other similar sorts of social media, and whether that empowers, those capabilities empower such movements, or whether in fact they actually are a net benefit to authoritarian regimes. The argument in the latter case, of course, being that such networks are basically open, so you're giving to the secret police your social network of all of your friends and colleagues that you're seeking to organize a protest or a strike or whatever with. Do you have any sense of whether, when we go, we'll just use Twitter as a stand-in, is a help or a hindrance to these sorts of operations, these sorts of campaigns?
It really depends on the context and probably on the specific campaigns that are done by the movement during a given time of resistance. So, for example, Facebook has been used by Ukrainians in the recent revolution against Yanukovych, as it is used by the same activists to do a number of nonviolent actions against Russian military aggression and occupation of Crimea. So during, for example, revolution, there were a number of groups set up by neighborhood watch groups of people living in Kiev in order to set up non-violent defense units to protect the neighborhoods against thugs, against government paid thugs who were attacking the activists. So Facebook was very helpful for those neighborhood groups to organize, to get together the members from tens to hundreds or thousands, and set up the meetings and set up the schedule of when they would go out and protect the neighborhoods. Now, activists were using also Facebook to distribute photos of the paramilitary groups and people who are part of the security, interior security troops, to identify them, to identify the rank, to identify their names. So they were doing a kind of public shaming. It wasn't for the purpose of going after them or their families to hurt them, but it was for the purpose of finding the perpetrators and naming the perpetrators. Now, in other contexts, in Iranian context, for example, when there was a green movement, indeed, the Iranian authorities were using pictures that were uploaded by activists on Facebook to identify activists this time and to arrest them and in that way also undermine and crush the movement. The principle of organizing nonviolent resistance is based on openness and transparency, because after all, civil resistance is successful because it's able to mobilize hundreds of thousands or millions of people. This cannot be done in secrecy. That's why the military resistance, usually it's so ineffective in mobilizing millions if it's very secretive, if it's not open. And civil resistance by its nature is very open. So that's, on one hand, it may expose civil resistance movements to increasing repression. On the other hand, it can actually facilitate participation, and that participation would be greater than any repression that the authorities can mobilize. And at the peak of the participation, the government might be weakened enough that defections would occur in the security, for example, forces. That would then make for the government, made much more difficult for the government to carry on that repression, even if it's willing to do that, but no longer has capacity to implement it.
Changing directions just a little bit, I get the impression that at least in the United States, that a lot of the thinking, a lot of the sort of the structured thinking about strategic nonviolent conflict actually in some ways has its roots in military thought, or maybe some of the early thinkers were former military officers. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, it was Gene Sharp who wrote in 1973 seminal volume, three volume book on politics of nonviolent action, where he kind of brought the strategic framework of analyzing nonviolent conflict into scholarship. But he himself, he was a conscientious objector. He was arrested during the Korean War for refusing to be drafted. So he himself didn't have the kind of, he had more anti-military background than anything else. But indeed, then a number of people who were at Fletcher's School of Law and Diplomacy, they, and particularly Peter Ackerman, for example, who approached the subject from a security studies perspective. And the book that was published by my colleagues, Erika Chenoweth and Maria Stefan, Why Civil Resistance Works, in 2011, that compares the effectiveness of violent versus nonviolent resistance. It also takes a very kind of strategic perspective that comes. Actually, Erika Chenoweth has had previous background in terrorism, and my colleague Maria Stefan has background in security studies. So, the connection of civil resistance with other disciplines is there. So, for example, there is some input from social movements literature, from contentious politics, but also from political science. The basic really starting point for civil resistance is understanding political power. And saying that political power is derived from the people rather than based on institutions or power holders. And simply because power holders need to maintain the political power through obedience and consent. And if that obedience and consent is collectively withdrawn and in an organized fashion by ordinary people, then those rulers, no matter how repressive they are, they cannot rule the country. Particularly if they lose also obedience and consent of the key pillars of their support. And the understanding of political power would come from different disciplines. But civil resistance makes that more kind of grounded, the understanding of political power in the agency of ordinary people.
Now, with military history, in general, rather good records are kept. There are certainly exceptions to this, but most wars are fought by, or at least have been, fought by governments against governments, or at least governments against things that wanted to be governments. And you know, these are bureaucracies that keep records. But the movement in Tahrir Square or in Kiev or whatever is quite a different proposition, not bureaucratized. So how solid really are the historical foundations of what we think we know about strategic nonviolent conflicts?
Personally, I think there is still quite a lot to be uncovered about past civil resistance. And the very purpose of my book, Recovering Nonviolent History, Civil Resistance in Liberation Struggles, was to look into a relatively unknown campaigns of nonviolent resistance during independence struggles, where one would expect usually those independent struggles to be led by armed resistance on both sides, because there was so much was at stake oftentimes, existential stakes, both for perhaps empires that were afraid of the breakup and they wanted to maintain that they wanted to make sure that they structures, colonial structures remain intact. And those local people that wanted to gain self-rule. So for both of them, there were existential struggles where one would expect quite a lot of violence. And we uncovered a number of cases that were not yet, I think, investigated in depth, the role and impact of civil resistance. It's very difficult indeed to historically to analyze civil resistance, because oftentimes civil resistance actions that may be about withdrawal, about silence, about not doing things, to be registered in historical annals, to be registered by historians, because if something didn't happen, why it should be written about? Whereas civil resistance could be largely about something that didn't happen, really, that people didn't allow their children, let's say, in the French colonial Algeria to go to French schools. They kept them in the homes and were educated them in Arabic and in the local culture. And in that way, through kind of civil, kind of hidden civil resistance, they were also building, shaping their national identity. And we oftentimes see those independent struggles as, you know, the result of breakup of violent breakup of empires or some kind of modernization project, moving people from the rural areas to urban communities. But we, I didn't come across, and that was the goal of the study of the book, of the analysis that would look at civil as the role of civil resistance in the formation of the nation states, rather than those structures or violence that really we focused on.
Let's turn to the situation in Ukraine, an endlessly fascinating and rather alarming situation, in my opinion at least. How would you assess the Euromaidan protests up until the Russian takeover of Crimea? How did they do?
So we talk really about 92 days from the end of November till February 21st when Yanukovych fled the capital. So this 92 days, that was the period of revolution in Ukraine. And there were a number of processes that could be really explained very effectively through the lenses of strategic nonviolent conflict. The mobilization of an armed population that took place at the end of November and throughout December was the result of, on one hand, Ukrainians being dissatisfied first of all, with an abrupt and sudden decision to change direction and end the negotiations with the EU and turn more towards Russia by the Yanukovych regime, but also appalled by the corruption and increasing authoritarianism that was present in Ukraine since Yanukovych came to power in 2010. But they were also appalled by the use of violence against unarmed protesters. So the use of violence backfired at the end of November and mobilized hundreds of thousands of people in December, leading also to a number of defections from the ruling party, from the local administrations, from the police. So we had the process of mobilization, we had the process of backfire, and we had the process of defections that I think could be effectively explained through the civil resistance perspective. Ukrainians, and I call that a syndrome of the Orange Revolution, they thought that they chose nonviolent actions almost by default, because that's what they were doing 8 years earlier. But in the next 2 months, according to some of the activists, they didn't manage to achieve much, although I would disagree with that. Well, they were saying that Yanukovych, it's not yielding, it's not starting negotiations, it's not offering any concessions, despite our impressive nonviolent resistance actions. And at the same time, Yanukovych regime was using targeted violence, continued using targeted violence, kidnapping activists, beating them up, and the activist thought that that nonviolent resistance doesn't look effective given those two things, and some of them increasingly started calling for more aggressive and more violent type of actions. And this was the start, sometime at in January, in the middle of January, of more kind of the radicalization of a small part of the movement. And we talk about a couple of hundreds of activists that formed what I call the kind of radical flank or violent flank of the movement. And that's when the discipline kind of broke down, and we saw. But also that was the time when the media started showing all those images of Molotov cocktails, of burning tires, and kind of creating a narrative of the movement. Whereas, again, it was limited. If we have 92 days of resistance, 5-6 days, that's when the violence was used. The rest of the time, it was nonviolent organizing, nonviolent resistance, protests, demonstrations, boycotts. So it was limited in terms of its scope and in terms of number of people. And at the same time, in my view, it was not a major factor that eventually contributed to the downfall of Yanukovych. Yanukovych actually was quite happy to face with the regime violent protesters, because that justified the propaganda that they are fighting with ultra-nationalists or fascists. And in this way, they could use violence or the apparatus of repression without any... it would be indiscriminate use of violence.
So it would have almost made it appear that the government's use of violence then might have been justified in order to suppress these violent protesters.
Exactly. And that happened also in Syria. Once the resistance became violent, it was much easier for Assad to justify the use of indiscriminate violence by saying that he's facing with armed resistance, and he was no longer paying, he was no longer constrained by anything. In fact, he started using his planes and chemical weapons when the resistance turned violent. He didn't use that when that resistance was nonviolent. So, and Yanukovych, coming back to Ukraine, he devised the plan that required 22,000 security forces to crush Maidan. Essentially, this plan was almost like a second Tiananmen. It would lead to second Tiananmen in Central Europe, and he was quite happy to do that. The thing was that his willingness to use violence didn't equal his capacity to do that, because when he started to mobilize those 22,000 troops, he realized that he doesn't have obedience of the. He doesn't secure the obedience of the army. So a number of army units that were asked to come to Kiev, their presence never materialized in Kiev.
They just sort of opted out.
They opted out, they stayed in the barracks. And Yanukovych didn't have enough force to implement his plans of crushing Maidan. So eventually, his departure was facilitated both by army defections and political defections. But those defections were facilitated not so much by the violent flank that was relatively ineffective, in my view, but rather by the mobilization of hundreds of thousands of people around grievances that those who defected actually shared with that movement.
Now, in other conversations that you and I have had, you've mentioned to me that from the point of view of the resistance, that defections from the army or perhaps from the police can actually be dangerous to the movement. Do you want to elaborate on that? I thought that was a very interesting point that you made to me.
Right, there are different types of defections. So on one level, it could be defections more kind of hidden, where the troops or the officers in the army would say that would implement the orders, but incompetently. They would still kind of say that we are kind of part of the structure, but they would be doing those or implementing those orders without much professionalism. So, for example, if someone is asking them, mobilize, go on the street and take live ammunition, it would take them a couple of days to find that live ammunition.
The ammunition bunker is locked and we can't find the guy who has the key.
Right, exactly. And it's difficult to figure out whether they are doing, whether this is indeed the problem, or they are kind of making it up. But some of the factions could be much more open when the army would join, or some army units would join the movement on the streets, and some of this kind of defections were very helpful because they strengthened the nonviolent movement. For example, in the Philippines or during the Orange Revolution, where in essence the army units without arms, they were with the people on the square. But some of this kind of defections could be dangerous for the nonviolent movement because they can bring people with arms. And instead of those people being integrated into the nonviolent movement, they can turn this nonviolent movement into armed resistance. And that's exactly what happened in Syria with the creation of the Free Syrian Army in August 2011, that eventually weakened the nonviolent movement and hijacked the nonviolent movement. Those guys came with weapons and they said, "Here we are right now to protect you. We've got weapons, we've got skills in using those weapons, so rely on us." So that was, there were the same type of defections, like during the Orange Revolution in 2004 or during the Philippines Revolution in 1986 against Marcos. But the soldiers, they didn't give up on armed resistance. On the contrary, they encouraged, they convinced actually activists that they might be a majority of the activists that they might be an effective force against Assad when the arms will be used against the regime.
So now that Russia has occupied Crimea, do the Ukrainians or the Crimean Tatars really have nonviolent resistance options there? Or if the Russians invade eastern Ukraine, are there serious and likely to be effective nonviolent options for resistance that might actually be effective?
Yes, so looking to the second question, so the kind of invasion, full-scale invasion, maybe occupation of larger parts of Ukraine, it's obvious, and that's what even Ukraine army analysts would admit, that there is no match in terms of conventional armed forces between Ukraine and Russia. So in that... So there is no perspective of winning the conventional warfare for Ukrainians against Russians. So that's so a number of Ukrainians said that the guerrilla war, the partisan warfare might be the best kind of option. Now, the question should be really asked about the risks and costs associated with any choice of the resistance. In my view, with the guerrilla warfare, the cost for the resistance would be that ethnic Russians who are living in Ukraine, they will seek the protection of the Russian army, and as we talk about almost 20% of the Ukrainian population, siding with the Russian army. Also, the dead soldiers who would be displayed on Kremlin could mobilize and rally around the flag Russians even more than they are right now. And at the same time, the destruction of the civilian death and destruction of the cities could be quite comparable to what we had in Syria. Now, that's why, given those analyses of the possible cost of the violent resistance should be juxtaposed with the analysis of the possible costs and benefits of nonviolent resistance. If one objective of struggle is to keep the population united, Ukrainian population united against the Russian invasion, why at the same time increasing sympathy, maybe among ordinary Russians, for Ukrainians, nonviolent actions and nonviolent resistance might actually be, and certainly in many cases in the past show that, would be much more effective in that context. And eventually, sustaining occupation is based on organization of the country. That country has to have the lights on, has to have the trains coming on time, has to have the bureaucracy running. Russians would need to rely on the local population to do that. If local population refuses to do that, this puts the cost on the occupation itself. It undermines the effectiveness of the occupation, and eventually it may take time. When Czechs and Slovaks decided to fight Russians or Soviets non-violently in 68, it took them 20 or so years to gain the independence. But then the basis from which they could start building the country, building democracy, were different than the basis that, for example, Syrians would have right now after armed resistance to build their own democracy. So the perspective of democracy emerging after nonviolent resistance is much, much higher than the perspective of democracy emerging after successful armed resistance, if it's even successful. Given what can be done in strategic terms against the invasion or occupation, with which costs and risks, and given the perspective of building democracy in the future, civil resistance certainly looks like more superior weapon. Now, in terms of Crimea, it's said that majority of the commentators would say that this is, and rightly so, that this is illegal annexation, but one needs to stress that this was also illegitimate, illegitimate referendum that took place. Referendum didn't really show exactly the true preferences of the Crimeans. Although majority of the commentators, as I said, they kind of accepted that majority of Crimeans wanted to join Russia. No, there were surveys done even during the revolution that showed that around 40% of the Crimeans wanted indeed to join Russia. Now, but this is not 96% as it is as it was in that referendum. Actually, if there were open if there was open referendum with not censored media, where actually the people would be given maybe four choices: whether they want to join Russia, whether they want to be independent, or whether they want to have greater autonomy or status quo. It's very unlikely that absolute majority would vote for independent for joining Russia. I think that most would opt for the greater autonomy or even status quo. Actually, the leader that was nominated by Crimean Parliament, which was surrendered by Russian troops to lead Crimea to independence and then to eventual annexation with Russia, he was the leader of Unity Russia party that got 4% of the votes in the local parliamentary elections to Crimean Parliament in 2012.
Not exactly a ringing endorsement.
No. And so if referendum it's illegitimate in the sense of not showing a true and honest preferences of the voters, that means that there is a substantive group, if not majority. Maybe we talk about, 30, 40%, maybe 50% of people that might be increasingly dissatisfied with the arrangement. And that would include Tatars, of course, Ukrainians, but it can also include ethnic Russians. And if we look at what happened in Abkhazia and South Ossetia after they got independence from Georgia in terms of economic development, well, local people, they don't see much change in terms of their standard of living. They see actually more SUVs and luxurious cars and some of the residences that the local officials have. Now, which means that any subsidies that are coming to Moscow are really stolen by the local politicians. This is likely to be the case also in Crimea, which this would create even more grievances on the part of the population. So right now, people are scared. There are a number of activists, but they are keeping low profile. Oftentimes, they are in hiding, and some parts of the population that might be coming out later, expressing their grievances. Right now, they are more fearful, And I think that at this moment, what needs to happen, and that's really the task of the Ukrainian activists and maybe to a certain extent international community, is to provide opportunities for a free flow of uncensored information to Crimean citizens. Most of the Crimeans are watching TV, Russian and previously Ukrainian TV, state TV channels that are heavily censored. So the resistance would start from resisting the censorship and providing information that would present also a more kind of objective picture about what's going on in Ukraine and what happened exactly in Crimea. And we will probably see a number of flash mobs. For example, when in one school there was the rising of the Russian flag, during the rising of the flag in Crimea, in Sevastopol, students started singing spontaneously Ukrainian anthem, national anthem. And they were, some of the teachers tried to silence them. Finally, the music, the orchestra started playing, so they couldn't be heard. And then a number of students just left the square where the whole event was taking place. So we would see more this type of kind of spontaneous expression of resistance, but oftentimes that would be registered, meaning someone will capture that on video, and that video would then be published somewhere online and would be then shared among activists, and also showing, and that will be shown, that will be an indication for the Crimeans that there are certain spots of resistance, and not that that there's unanimity about what happened, and it may encourage others to be braver.
Well, on that encouraging note, thank you so much for a fascinating discussion. We've been talking today with Dr. Maciej Bartkowski, and if you're one of our students and you found this discussion interesting, I'd encourage you to register for his course in the fall, Civil Resistance, The Logic of a Strategic Nonviolent Conflict, and also buy his book, Recovering Nonviolent History, published in 2013. So, Maciej, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Mark. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University. For information about our part-time graduate programs, go online to advanced.jhu.edu. We hope you'll join us next time.